Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Jordan Clopton, and I have our CEO and Portfolio Manager, Michael Cugino, on the call with me. This is our Q4 Portfolio Manager Q&A session. This has been a very interesting February for sure, which means no shortage of things to talk about. I hope we get a lot of great questions from everyone. Speaking of questions, right now everyone is in listen-only mode. Once I turn the call over to Michael, he will kick things off with a Q4 review and obviously touch on some of the issues of the past week or two. After Michael wraps up his thoughts, we will turn it over to questions. You have two options for asking questions. You can click on the little hand icon and I will unmute your line, or you can simply email me a question using the little text box. Okay, so with that out of the way, I want to thank everyone again for giving us some of your time, and I'll get out of the way and let Michael jump in. So go ahead, Michael.
Thank you, Jordan. I'd like to thank everybody for calling in, prospective investors, existing investors, or just people with genuine interest. Thank you very much. As Jordan said, you know, the last year finished up in an interesting fashion, but yet it was a totally different market than really what started right after literally the beginning of the year. It's almost like there's a bright line on December 31 and you had two different markets. The market of last year and last quarter being a gradual bleed up, anticipation of better regulatory and fiscal policy. The tax cut momentum took place in the latter part of the quarter, and that helped propel stocks. The expectations and the recalibrations of corporate earnings under a new tax regime all, I think, contributed to the year end in equities and in other asset classes to a lesser degree. You know, commodities rose up and precious metals and the like as well. Starting in this year, I mean, one thing we've been saying quite a bit for a while now is that we expected volatility to increase, and that did in fact happen and likely is going to continue to happen. I think the gains so far, you know, very aggressive January, February that so far has been all over the place. I think we're still up positive for the year in the equity markets, but it's been quite a wild ride, and a lot of the gains from January have been reversed out, at least for the moment. The VIX is trading at multi-year highs. You've seen tremendous flows going in different directions. There's been whispers of margin calls in different asset classes, and you've had some issues in some ETFs that were supposed to be, had an expected level of performance in markets like this that did not perform or are not performing up to standards. And all these are indicative of higher volatility periods. They're not these things aren't unusual. They're normal. I think probably the biggest issue is that, we haven't had a correction, really a technical correction. This week we had a brief one. I think it was yesterday. But we really haven't had even a technical one for, literally February 2016. So you had a period of 2 years with pretty benign markets. And so I think going forward, this is going to be the norm. Again, our firm's been saying for a long time that at some point the reconciliation, I'll go back to my accounting days, the reconciliation between fiscal policy and monetary policy was going to have to occur, and that could be a bumpy ride. The liquidity that's been created over the last several years, regardless of its velocity and where it's been parked or what it's been doing, there's been wealth, money created, and it remains to be seen in a different economic circumstance how much of that liquidity was needed, will be needed, et cetera. In addition, you have really a sea change in climate. I would argue that probably the last 8 years and maybe even going back into the final years of the Bush administration, you had somewhat of an economy that was slowing down or in recession or growing, but at anemic rates. You had quantitative easing, you had low interest rates, you had lack of monetary velocity, you had money going into stocks and bonds and real estate versus productive assets. And the incentives, fiscal and tax-wise, were geared towards that sort of behavior. And so they encouraged that sort of behavior. We are now, in the last year or so, really shifting gears with respect to less regulation, a more growth-oriented tax policy, but growth in terms of productive economic growth. The accelerated depreciation items, as an example, in the new tax bill, and the focus on infrastructure, the focus on industrials, the focus on Made in America, all these sorts of things are promoting a sort of economic growth scenario. So it's what we're seeing is the early stages, in all likelihood, of a redeployment of capital between investing types of assets into productive economic assets. That's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, probably in the long term, it's a healthy thing. But it's going to create some disruption and dislocation. I think we're seeing some of that. Interest rates are rising. And recently, after the yield curve consolidating a little bit, in the last week and a half or so, we've seen spreads like the 2-10 and the 5-30 begin to widen out a little bit, especially the 2-10. That's also probably reflective of stronger economic data, probably a reaction to the inflationary data that came out last week on wages, and probably healthy in terms of a growth scenario, but also indicating the likelihood of more interest rate hikes, or at least the expected 2-4 that the Fed's been talking about versus maybe a 0-2 or 3 that some people had hoped for. You, in addition, have a brand new Fed chair. While the markets believe that they understand him and how he's going to think and how he's going to behave, that's always an interesting thing as the markets and the new direction of the Fed, or at least under the new chairman, begin to get to know each other a little bit more. And so that also adds some uncertainty. So all these factors are out there, and I'll get back to them in a second. I just want to touch on our portfolios briefly, and then get back to where I see we're positioned and how we how we stack up in all of this. But permanent portfolio for the calendar year ended was up 11.43%. That's in its iShares class. That comes off of the data sheet that many, or if not all of you, have already received. The primary drivers of performance, obviously everybody knows that it's a multiple asset class strategy, low volatility, tax efficient strategy, and one that focuses on diversification all the time. Most of the return was driven by stocks last year, especially aggressive growth stocks with lesser contribution from natural resources and real estate. So of the 11%, probably 8% rough numbers was driven by equity performance. The remaining 2-3% was driven by primarily gold, a little bit of help from silver, and to a lesser degree bond yields, especially the treasuries and Swiss bonds and the high grade corporates. But to a much lesser degree. So if you broke it down, it's probably 8%, 2.5%, 1%, something along those lines gets you the 11.5. So it was broadly based in terms of the how the asset classes performed, and I think they were reflective of the actual economic activity and the market dynamics that were actually at play. The primary equity driving industry sectors were entertainment, leisure, and technology, manufacturing, and transports. Again, in anticipation of better economic activity, more activity, focus on industrial productive assets. Those categories did well. Financials probably to a lesser degree also contributed there. And the top three non-performing categories were really not. They were more break even than non-performing, electronics, communications, and some industrial materials. And so it was a good year for permanent portfolio in terms of obviously well behind equity markets, but that's expected. When you look at our history in that fund, we generally try to capture, depending on the period of measurement, which you can see on your data sheets, we capture a significant portion of equity performance with a much lower beta to this stock and bond market. So it's a lower volatility, more diversified product that's designed to offset or hedge against, you know, typical stock and bond only risk. You know, the one of the negatives with a diversified strategy like that is when you have a run like last year in a certain asset class, you're never going to outperform it, and unless you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing. And so it's no surprise that you know, our performance probably stacked up where it was. And the positive is that if you get one or more asset classes that have significant downtrends, the losses are mitigated. So it's a strategy, you know, and we continue to manage that strategy the same way that we always have, with a long-term focus, a multi-year focus, and a strategic overlay of different assets all the time. And, you know, adjust accordingly based on what we see out in the marketplace. The aggressive growth portfolio, the stock fund, was up 21.21% for the calendar year. And I would say that probably very similar drivers. Obviously, the stock market had a good year, you know, regardless of which index you're looking at. I mean, there was a lot of good performance across the equity sector, and I think our portfolio reflected that. I would probably say, again, just like it, the equity drivers and permanent portfolio, the primary drivers were, you know, the entertainment and leisure, the manufacturing, the industrials, the transports, to a lesser degree, financials, and probably the same or similar non-performers, or at least break-even performers. So that portfolio is designed to be an all-cap equity driver. It's designed for equity investors. Again, it has a long-term focus, and we try to minimize turnover. We try to make longer-term investing decisions and not, you know, over-trade the portfolio. And we don't necessarily weight it to the S&P or any other index in terms of how we apply investments. So, you know, there are funds out there that will look at the S&P weightings and will sort of align their portfolios in light of those and tweak them a little bit here and a little bit there. We don't manage it that way. While we look to beat that index, we pay attention to our own weightings and our own sectors and our own names, and not necessarily weight them in any relationship to the actual index themselves. So I think that gives us a little differentiation in the marketplace as to how that fund can be used, you know, vis-a-vis the overall stock market. The versatile bond portfolio was up 71 basis points for the year, and I think it reflected the combination of rising interest rates and coupled with the types of investments that we are, you know, we are primarily in. The portfolio remains mostly in investment grade bonds. At December 31, we were approximately 75% in investment grade securities, with a duration in that portfolio of an average duration of 3.88 and an effective duration of 3.74. Again, all this stuff's on the data sheets, but we remain committed to our strategy of staying relatively short and focusing on high grade investment grade credits and balance sheets, in the belief that the interest rate picture is going to continue to be volatile and likely volatile on the upside. And so we've wanted to and have for a while maintain a fairly conservative stance with respect to balance sheets and duration. So we've probably given up a little bit on the basis points in light of flexibility. And while that potentially maybe hurt us in the recent past, it may turn out to be an advantage going forward. And when you look at the return, you know, if you look at rising market rates and the Fed's actions over the last year, they make sense with a shorter duration. The final portfolio, the short-term treasury portfolio, had a return of 12 basis points. And I think that reflects its average duration of 0.5, you know, roughly 0.5 or a half a year, and in an interest rate environment that was rising all year. So the portfolio, you know, the positive there is that shorter term treasuries are going up and the portfolio is able to take advantage of that. The portfolio continues to provide a place for, you know, very conservative investing, a place to park capital and earn, you know, short term treasury yields. While you're looking for your next opportunity, or for the ultra conservative investor just to have some in treasuries. all four of our portfolios continue to perform as expected. There's been no changes to our thinking, to our strategy, to our procedures, and any, you know, anything like that, so to speak. And so, you know, where does that position us going forward? I guess, you know, speaking of the two bond funds, I think probably I've adequately spoken about those. I think being short, being high quality, I think investors are going to begin to get rid of high risk fixed income securities over time, especially as interest rates go up. We've been saying this for a while, and our timing may have been a little off, but I think we got the long-term concept right. And so I think being high quality and being short is where you want to be. You want to be able to ride up the yield curve as it goes up. And again, focus on, you know, minimizing what you lose in a volatile market environment, which we may experience. I think investors, we tend to do this in our shop, a lot. And I think investors, some do, some don't. I don't think many do sometimes. Where, you know, focusing on keeping what you're making along the way is as important as making it. And we're a firm that has traditionally been very conservative. And, you know, I would say that probably given our strategies, you know, diversification is in our DNA, even when we're in single asset class strategies, and certainly in permanent portfolio. And that conservatism can hurt us on the basis points or on return periodically. But we think in the long term, given the environment we're in right now, it's an advantage, and it's something that one would want to consider in this environment. With respect to equities, you know, we're not down on equities, and I think to some degree the current environment, at least the last few days, if it continues for a while, may present some opportunities. Volatility a lot of times does present opportunities where you're looking at names, you get into some names you've been wanting to get into for a while, but they haven't been priced right, or, you know, other circumstances may have come into play. So the volatility is decent. I think when you look at the equity market, again, in the short term, I think it's going to be volatile. And you look at a day like today, where the close happened right before we got on this call, and there was a tremendous amount of movement within, but we ended up the day not much different than when we started. Then you look at a day like yesterday, where you had roughly a 1,000-point range in trading, and obviously on Monday it was you know, kind of flat to negative for a while, and then it fell off a cliff. So much more volatility so far this year, and I expect that to continue in the short term. Having said that, when you look at equities over the long term, you know, at the moment you have very good corporate earnings. You have a tax plan that is likely going to, you know, even if business remains the same, you're going to potentially have a lot more percentage point drop to the bottom line in terms of profits due to the lower tax rates. You also have expanded and increased rates of depreciation that I expect a lot of firms are going to take advantage of over the next couple of years or so, which will further decrease taxable income and really benefit the long-term perspectives of the businesses and probably, you know, cash from operations once you make the expenditures to buy the capital assets. And, you know, to the extent CapEx improves, that's going to be good for the economy. It's going to be good for a lot of industries in a lot of places. So, you know, you've got corporate earnings. You have a yield curve that does not look like it's inverting yet. You have an economy that appears to be gaining strength in the U.S., as well as abroad. You have global interest rates increasing as well as U.S. rates. So, you know, for the first time in a while, interest rates are moving in tandem, and the central banks may be beginning to move in tandem. That's also a positive. That also likely will put pressure on the dollar and, you know, potentially weaken the dollar through market forces versus QE, which is very different. And that will allow for U.S. companies to be aggressive in overseas expansion and productive, you know, in non-U.S. environments as well. So the economic picture is conducive for stocks in the long term. And so I think money can be made there. I think you do have to be more careful. With a gradual melt up like we had the last couple of years and really for the better part of the last several years, you know, indexing was a no-brainer. And I think that scenario probably ended on January 1st, at least in the short term here. And I think the volatility is going to really impact that. So if you're a long-term investor, that still may work, but get ready for a bumpy ride. And for shorter-term investors or investors that may like the opportunity of earning more in a volatile market versus just an index, I think it presents a lot of opportunity. Like any asset class, though, there's risks. And so the risks, I think, to the stock market right now, and they are real. I think the positives outweigh the negatives to a degree, but these risks are real. And there's nothing that says they can't expand and take over outweigh the positives at some point. But I would say the rate and pace of interest rate increases, inflation, and probably geopolitical and political and military risk to the global economy and to the U.S. economy. I think those are probably the big three situations that could derail the story. Obviously, rising interest rates, if they're gradual, it's a natural byproduct of economic growth. And so far, the interest rates we've seen, for the most part, have been gradual. There's been some bumps, but for the most part, I would still consider these gradual increases in light of where economic growth is going. But if the pace increases, if the Fed perceives that there's too much inflationary pressure, and I think one of the reasons for the sell-offs last week was the rise in rates that was due in part caused by the wage inflation number, which was a lot higher than I think people expected, and a general feeling that inflation is going to go up in this sort of economy driven by growth, and that could cause the Fed to have to move quicker or market rates to go up too quickly, and that could derail, the economy and the economic growth that we have, here, and to the extent this replicates itself around the world, it would be a similar thing. The other thing would be, things like trade and trade agreements not being renewed or being poorly renewed or renegotiated, geopolitical risks, skirmishes around the world between countries, disruption, unrest, et cetera. Those things, at this point, you have a lot of things going right in a lot of places. And there's always the fear that something could disrupt that. And these are the types of things that, over the long term would cause disruption. If Brexit isn't handled properly and causes dysfunction on the European continent, for example, the ability to not do business the way it's been done the last 20 years in the short term would really mess everybody up. And that could, further mess up economic growth there. And that would translate to other parts of the world. To the extent the dollar doesn't do what we think it does and upends emerging markets instead of helps them, I think that's also a risk. And so I think this is an environment, given the volatility, given the mostly positive bent on growth, but there are risks out there and investors should pay attention. Our portfolio, our permanent portfolio, I think was built for times like this. In fact, it was created during an inflationary environment, and a lot of the assets that we invest in are growth-oriented assets, and so we would expect to do decently in a situation like this, and we tend to do better in volatile markets versus one-directional markets. So I think that's something that we're well positioned for. When you look at the various asset classes within the portfolio, I think our equity exposure is weighted towards growth, high beta type stocks that are weighted towards growth, big financials, the same things that I mentioned earlier, transports, industrials, financials, materials, natural resources, I think are all things, and as well as traditional growth stocks. I think biotech is potentially poised for an upturn, and technology providing companies still produce profits, I think, are still legitimate places to be. On the commodity side of things, I do believe that we probably bottomed out in the commodity cycle within the last year or two. And, while it remains to see what kind of an upside we have in this cycle, I think when you look at the growing global growth, which enhances demand, potentially weaker dollar caused by rising global interest rates, and if you do get, benign political and military and trade risk, then you probably have an upswing for commodities. And that'd be a longer-term cycle. And I think that, that benefits us. real estate investment trusts and real estate have had a tough time lately on rising interest rates. But assuming interest rates rise gradually, real estate tends to benefit as well in a growth economy, because you can write new leases at higher rates, and you need space, residential and office space and warehousing space and all this stuff to actually transact business. And so cash flows increase, dividends increase, et cetera. So from a total return standpoint, the sell-off in REITs lately has been interesting. And always we have exposure to precious metals, gold and silver, in the extent that inflation and there is a reactionary knee-jerk trade that happens in the marketplace a lot, where interest rates go up, people sell metals, people sell gold because it doesn't produce income and the opportunity cost to own it, and et cetera, et cetera. The problem with that argument is you probably want to diversify your inflationary risk, if you want to call it that, with bonds and gold, because both yields go up in, shorter term bonds with increasing yields and gold, because the things that drive an increase in the price of or in the yields of bonds would also drive an increase in the value of gold. And as the unit value of the dollar declines, the value of gold goes up against that dollar, and you preserve your purchasing power. So it's part of our wealth building and maintaining strategy, and we continue to expect it to be going forward along the lines that we've always used it. And then finally, our Swiss sovereign debt, those investments have worked very well for us over the last several years, because as people have, whether it was the currency or the bonds, people have invested in them, driven down yields, in some cases into negative yields. For us, we bought them long before they went negative. So we've been able to benefit to a certain degree from that as well. And that gives you some international fixed income exposure on the sovereign side that helps to offset what's going on in the United States. And we also do some investment grade corporates that are non-US as well. So I think overall, we're well positioned for this environment. And if you look at our historical results, permanent portfolio has been in operation since 1982. We've lived through many, many different markets and market variants, and we've produced a return that has beat inflation as measured by the 90-day Treasury bill over our 36-year history. And so, I think for times like this, we represent something that would be useful in many client portfolios. If you look at our longer-term performance, over the last 15 years, we returned approximately 7.5% on a stock market as measured by the S&P of 10%. You're looking at a three quarters of stock market performance over the last, 15 years, with probably a third to half of the volatility. Similarly, if you look at us since 1982, we had a return of a little more than 6% on an equity performance of about 11.5. So a little more than 50% equity returns, again, with a lot less volatility. And so I think, and an inflation rate, over that time of probably as measured by the 3-month Treasury bill of approximately, a little under 4%. So you're looking at something like, 200 plus basis points beating inflation over the history of the fund. Obviously, some years it's better than others, but that's what you're getting. And I think for an investor, for any investor as a diversifier, as a part of a portfolio, to say in over that history getting a 6% yield, beating inflation by a few percentage, a couple percentage points, as a portion of a portfolio, it would seem to be desirable for many portfolios at some level. I mean, obviously it may not be the only strategy one uses, but at some level it is useful, and we've always positioned it that way. We believe in it. And with that, I'll take questions. Those are, my remarks, and I'll stay as long as there are questions out there to answer. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. So again, if anybody has any questions, just, hit the hand icon or use a little text box and shoot me a question. We'll give it a second, see if anybody has any questions. Okay, so we're not getting any questions at the moment, but Michael, just real quick, I mean, we talked about, you know, volatility, inflation, you know, your main three worries, sort of three legs of the stool. Can you speak a little bit more to sort of, you know, the environment that Permanent Portfolio Fund has seen, you know, why it's maybe a good tool, you know, in terms of lowering correlation, and managing beta and so forth?
Well, I think the benefits or how it achieves that, the lower beta and managing correlations, is that, you know, correlations are constantly changing among asset classes, and people are trading various things off each other all the time. So the concept of correlation or lack of is not set in stone. I think what gives the portfolio the ability that it has, and I would make this argument for a lot of non-correlative strategies, which, you know, in the last 20 years have proliferated, but the fact that we have dedicated exposure all the time to certain asset classes guarantees that we're going to be in certain places all the time. And that allows the non-correlative features of our portfolio's asset classes to really be themselves in multiple market environments. So in the shorter term, anything can correlate with each other or not. And we've seen positives and negatives of that sort of concept, you know, throughout time. But if you're constantly dedicated to asset classes, you're going to have periods where, and it's probably the majority of the time, where the assets behave like the DNA that they are, you know, that the DNA that they possess. And so that will hold true in a longer term investment horizon with correlation and lack of correlation. And so I think our long-term strategy, the fact that we have a strategic overlay versus a pure, you know, tactical moving in and out of markets and sectors and asset classes, there's room for that in strategies, don't get me wrong, but it's not us. You know, we're more a strategic, you know, permanence kind of thing, hence the name. And we obviously take advantage of opportunities within, you know, underneath that overlay, but we are going to always have a position in gold. We are always going to have a position in bonds. We're always going to have a position in, you know, two sleeves of equities. And while that may ebb and flow to a degree, we're always going to be there. And so I think the mistake people make in our portfolio sometimes is they'll overweight their review of us in one asset class and say, well, you know, you guys own bonds and I don't really want to be in bonds right now. You know, okay, fine, that's a tactical decision, but our portfolio is not designed to be pure tactical. And so you want bonds in a diversified fund, because what if you're wrong? And what if you need them? You know, what if you do experience the recession you didn't expect, or the deflation you didn't expect, or the balance sheet crisis you didn't expect? Then, you know, had you been purely tactical, you would have missed the move. And by being strategic and managing that strategic overlay, you're in the asset class to hedge, but also take advantage of opportunity, and you're there all the time. So I've used this term quite a bit over the years, and I think one of the things our portfolio does is it minimizes portfolio manager risk. And I would put myself as a potential risk factor, like I would any portfolio manager out there. Yeah, we can all be wrong, and are wrong a lot. And so by minimizing portfolio manager risk, you help to maintain and potentially profit from the strategy.
Michael, sorry about that. We've got a question from Pamela Gregg. Do you still own Wynn Group in your stock portfolio? I know that's a tough question to ask in terms of holding, so I guess just try your best.
It's a timely question. Currently, we own it, you know, that's not to say we will own it tomorrow, the next day, add to it, take away from it, et cetera. I make no predictions. But yes, we own it, and continue, like we do all of our securities, to assess why and whether we still want to own it. We all, you know, any holding we have is being vetted for, you know, an evolving story, and whether it's on the equity or the debt side. And so, you know, I could probably point to names we own, and they're in the news on a daily basis. And so I don't view anything particular with Wynn that I wouldn't view anywhere else, from the standpoint of, you know, we continue to assess evolving stories in all of our investments and examine them and determine how they impact our overall long-term thinking, and act accordingly. So we continue to do that all the way around. So Wynn would be no different there than anything else.
Okay. And to your earlier point, I would just add, yes, you know, you have to look at the permanent portfolio holistically, not analyze each individual slice of the portfolio. But, you know, the end result here is creating something that can you know, helps, I guess, smooth things out, you know, give you exposure to inflation-sensitive asset classes, can help sort of lower that correlation to the overall market. So, you know, if you are overweight equities, if you are overweight bonds, which many people may be considering the last 3, 4, 5 years, you know, our fund is a good way to, you know, help diversify away some of the risks that were all over the headlines this week and the week prior, correct? I mean,
well, keep in mind that you know, no one name is going to single-handedly drive our portfolio, or really any one asset class, because we're so diversified. So, you know, in a situation like an individual stock, I mean, this gets back to my previous point, like you're saying. You know, sometimes people will cite one item, you know, they'll cherry pick an item in the portfolio and say that bothers them, or it makes them happy. It can go both ways. And I would, you know, I tend to counsel people in either situation. Look, you got to look at this portfolio as a whole. You don't cherry pick asset classes or make a determination based on one. It's designed as a whole to be at its most effective. And so getting back to individual securities, I think, you know, news is happening every day with many companies, and you're forced to assess that news in light of your strategy, in light of your thinking, in light of valuations, et cetera, and your ability to sort of game plan out how things might go. Certainly that particular name has been in the news quite a bit in the last week and a half. It's, you know, had quite a leg down. It's recovered a good chunk of that, but not all of it. It's going to have a CEO change. They're in the middle of, you know, business initiatives. The CEO is a very high-profile person. And so, you know, those are all factors that get considered in the strategy. But I don't think any of us could predict where that name is going to go or how it's going to go going forward as an economic success or failure. So that's one of the things that, you know, we as portfolio managers, Derek and I, have to assess in light of factors and continue to assess. And like I said, that process goes on for all the names in our portfolio, you know, to the extent we need to, and it's ongoing. And when we feel that it's appropriate to make changes, we make them. So, you know, again, I'll stress, you know, usually we don't get individual names on this one. In these calls, you know, I make no representations on anything we're doing with that name one way or the other. But it is in the portfolio.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? All right. Well, I think that about does it. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Thanks everyone for joining us today. If you need any material, just email me, and we'll get it out to you. And again, thanks for the time, and take care.
Yeah, thank you, Jordan, and thanks everybody for your time and your interest and your investment, and good luck in the early days of 2018 here. So take care.